if you find something you want, you tear it out.
Oh, okay.
They'll get around one finger.
Was there much in there? There really wasn't much in there.
No, it's. I think it's kind of written from a secular viewpoint.
That's kind of what
more,
thought.
More from a, you know, I think there's a lot of different viewpoints of how different cultures, different religions, different beliefs look at death and what happens, along with the blending of Christianity and.
He just tried to buy it because of the name. It was kind of one of these things that I
well,
grasped.
Yeah, right.
You know,
Doomsday catalog. That's. You mean I'm not the only one that buys a book and then looks at its contents once I get it home?
Sorry.
Yeah, right, really. Oh, wow, no wonder it's cheap.
Yeah.
Let's turn to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. Start a new chapter here. See what I mean? By the time you hit chapters 21 and 22, it's sure good to be out of judgment and the Antichrist and everything. Just, I noticed about this time of the year, it starts getting bogged down a little bit, you know, and the plagues and everything and all the blood and the gore and so forth. Yes.
I was wondering in Revelation 12:17, what the significance was of the word, why wasn't it stated that the dragon was to make war with the remnant of the woman rather than the remnant of her seed?
Well, okay, now, I think part of it lies perhaps in the way it should be translated, like some translate it just simply the remaining ones.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. The remaining. Does the Greek text have the word, I don't know, for seed in there, separate from that? There obviously is a reason why. I have looked at this phrase, and I've looked at it a fair amount, and I think about the only significance I've been able to see, and I'm not sure I see it clearly, to be honest with you. Okay, the seed of her remaining ones? Or yeah, okay, so it does have the word seed. Well, the way I look at it is that John is seeing what is left of the woman, and these are her offspring, as it were. They are her seed, and of her seed, of her offspring, these are the remaining ones now. So whatever is left of the woman, and which seems to imply that a good portion of the woman is now gone, has now been killed in the first five seals or whatever. And whatever is left of her, the devil now is making war against the seed of her remaining ones. That's the idea that is in my mind. That's what it seems to be. Yes?
Could it be that just as man-child was separated out of her by distinction of relationship with the Lord, that there's also a lot of them that have fallen away before. But the whole woman in total, mm-hmm. the whole church, was the people that also took the mark and were damned. Mm-hmm. And the ones that got raptured were separated out and called to thieves. The ones that have also been faithful through martyrdom would almost, in a sense, be a seed from that whole group in which some of them weren't faithful.
Well, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't profess to have the light, full light on this passage. I just kind of look at it as the ones that are left over, so I really don't know. Maybe the pastor knows or something a little bit more definitively, but I don't.
Could the woman be negative of the church in general? No, you've had all the past generations that are dead, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That aren't even in a figurative sense, you know, because the use of the word seed, which is a generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you kind of get into a problem, though, when you say that there's a separation between the man-child, and then the woman flees into the wilderness for 1,260 days, and if you make the woman a picture of, historically, the believers in the church, then all of a sudden, how can they flee into the wilderness for 1,260 days? In other words, it seems to be looking at a separate body at a specific point in time. And then when the separation occurs, that body flees into the wilderness. I guess the way I've always looked at it is that the remnant of her seed is just simply talking about what is left of the woman. And he makes war against them. But whether that's the full picture or not, I really don't know. Well, let's hasten on to chapter 13. One more.
Here.
Yes. Yeah, right. That's who they would be. Right. What is left of them? Mm-hmm. What's left of them. Chapter 13 is very interesting. There's two principal symbols that are seen in this chapter. There is the beast out of the sea, and then the beast out of the earth, two beasts that are seen. And just to kind of make it simple for you, really what we're looking at, the first beast is the world government, and the second beast is going to be the false prophet. And the false prophet is going to be very, very instrumental in, solidifying, I suppose, the Antichrist in the hearts of the people on the earth. Very, very instrumental in that, as far as consolidating the Antichrist empire, working directly with him. And these two beasts are going to be a couple of the main instruments that the devil is going to use to direct his program during the Great Tribulation. Now, in chapter 12, we saw the tribulation from the viewpoint of the church on the earth. Now we're going to see it from the standpoint of the Antichrist system. So we're not going to look just at the persecuted tribulation church now. We're going to actually look at the Antichrist system. So now what we're going to do, starting in verse 1, we're going to go back in time a little bit to just before, or just after, I should say, the rapture. Just slightly after the rapture. So when we ended chapter 12, we were at the end of the tribulation period. Now we're going back and we're going to start the tribulation all over again with chapter 13. Let me read it to you. It says in chapter 13 and verse 1, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy." Now this is the same dragon with the seven heads and ten horns of chapter 12 and verse 3. But now there's a slightly different analogy here, with a slightly different emphasis. Now this is called a beast instead of a dragon. You'll notice that change right there. It's not being called a dragon, it's called a beast with seven heads and ten horns. And I think that the difference in emphasis is this. In chapter 12, the dragon is none other than Satan himself, showing that the devil is the force behind the Antichrist system. Now, the same system is called a beast, and it's pointing to the system itself. It's not really looking at the devil himself, but now it is looking at the system itself, and what it is telling you is about its character. It's like a beast, like a mauling, marauding beast. Now, sometimes in the book of Revelation, the word beast refers to the Antichrist himself as the head of the government, and other times it refers to just the system, like we're going to see throughout this chapter. In fact, throughout most of chapter 13, every single time it uses the personal pronoun he or him, you could actually translate it. Because very often in the Greek, when it uses the Greek verb, the third person singular is indefinite. It can be he, she, or it, and the context has got to really describe it or define it for you. So really, you could translate it here. For example, in chapter 13, verse 1, when it says, "I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads," and so forth, "and upon his horns," you could say, "and upon its horns." Because we're really not looking at one person now. We're not looking at the Antichrist per se, and we're not looking at the devil per se. We're looking at the actual system itself. And then later on in verse 5, we're going to see there is a mouth given to it, and the mouth that is given to it is then the Antichrist. Now, there is one exception to what I just got done saying, where you could take the pronouns and translate them it or its. The exception would be in verse 8. And there it uses a masculine intensive pronoun, and there it is definitely he, down in verse 8. It says, "And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him," I guess it's him, not he, but him, "whose names are not written in the book of life." That is talking about the Antichrist there, that they're going to worship him, the Antichrist. But other than that, the rest of the chapter pretty much is talking about the system. Now, this word beast is the Greek word thereon, and it means a wild beast. So it's talking about a wild, vicious, marauding, prowling, angry, upset, vicious, greedy, scary beast. That's T-H, long E, R-I-O-N, thereon. It's a wild beast. It's often used of a beast of prey, as here, and it's used of a viper which fastened itself to Paul's hand. For example, in Acts chapter 28 and verse 4, we read of a venomous beast, in Acts chapter 28, verse 4. Now, you'll notice on this beast that there are seven heads on it, which is the same as the dragon in chapter 12, representing the seven world governments, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and Antichrist. So the seven heads are the same. And then there are 10 horns on it. So we know that we're looking at something much greater than just the Antichrist. We're looking actually at the world system itself. The 10 horns would represent probably 10 powerful men who are going to reign as kings 1 hour with the beast. And their hour of dominion has commenced now with this chapter right here, because we read, upon his horns, 10 crowns. And so there are crowns now on these 10 horns. This is a symbol of governmental authority. So the horns have now come into full power at the beginning of this vision. We're at the beginning of the tribulation now. Governmental authority. These, incidentally, are diadems. They are royal crowns, indicating that their reign as kings has now begun. So they're reigning as kings. Now, that places the vision after the rapture, because before the rapture, there were no crowns on those 10 horns. If you look up at chapter 12 and verse 3, there are 10 horns, and then there are 7 crowns upon the 7 heads, but the 10 horns themselves have no crowns. Now they have their crowns. So now we're at a period of time after the rapture. So chapter 13, then, is the same time as the 1260 days of chapter 12 and verse 6. Same exact time element. When it said that the woman fled in verse 6 of chapter 12 into the wilderness for 1260 days, that's this very time in chapter 13. Let me read verse 5 to you. And there was given unto him a great mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. That's the tribulation period, that first 3.5 years. This is also the same as the first 6 seals of chapter 6, the time in which the Antichrist is going to go forth and conquer, and there's war and famine and death following and so forth. Now, we find that these 10 horns become kings by giving their power and strength to the beast. In chapter 17 and verse 12, it will tell you that. Chapter 17 and verse 12. So it's not like they're ruling independent of the Antichrist. They won't. They're ruling underneath him. They give their power, they give their authority to him, and he in turn gives them, as it were, a portion of his kingdom to rule over. Now, notice where this beast has come from. It rises up out of the sea in his vision. Now, the sea in the Bible represents the confused Gentile nations. They're agitated, they're troubled. And this is going to be the origin of the Antichrist system, from the Gentile nations. The waters speak of the nations and the peoples of the earth, according to chapter 17 and verse 15. So we're really looking at a political system right now. We're looking at the beast rising up out of the nations of the world. A couple interesting scriptures. In Psalm chapter 65 and verse 7, we read about God which stilleth the noise of the seas, the noise of their waves, and the tumult of the people. And there it equates the tumult of the people with the noise of the waves. In Daniel 7:2, Daniel saw the winds whipping the nations into a frenzy of commotion. And the beast is rising up out of those waves as well. Then Luke chapter 21, verse 25, the nations are going to be in great turmoil in the last days. In fact, you see, this is going to set the stage for the appearance of the Antichrist. It's going to give him his opportunity to arise. And the world is going to cry for a Superman to bring in and usher in peace and safety. Well, let me read on in chapter 13. It says in verse 1, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. Now, you know what blasphemy is. Blasphemy is a word or words that defame God, that detract from God, words that speak evil of God, words that speak evil of divine things. And what this is revealing is the attitude of this world government, and the attitude of this government against God and his truth. And they are going to blaspheme God. They're going to blaspheme his truth. They're going to blaspheme his nature. Now, incidentally, there is a manuscript variant here on the word name. Some manuscripts have name singular, and upon his heads, the name of blasphemy, singular, as the Authorized Version does. So there might be a name that would sum up all the false religions of the seven heads of the beast down through time that John is seeing, that characterizes them. But then many have names plural, including some of the better Greek texts, like Westcott and Horton, Nestle, and so forth, have names plural. And I think UBS does as well. and the New American Standard, and most of the other literal translations have names, plural. And what that has is the idea of each head has on it a blasphemous name. Now, I don't think that the Bible is so much looking at one specific name. It's just simply characterizing that world government. Every single one of these world governments have been blasphemous. They've been against God. They've been opposed to God. If you go back and look at them, Egypt, blasphemous. Assyria, blasphemous. Medo-Persia, Babylon, Greece, Rome, they were all blasphemous, all against God, and totally against the things of God. In fact, if you look at many of the Greek kings and the Roman kings and so forth, they actually accepted false divine titles. In fact, the Greek kings were called God the Savior, or the Manifest God. They'd see Alexander the Great, and they'd say, there's God the Savior. See, blasphemy. Julius Caesar accepted divine titles and honors, in fact, even erected temples to his worship. Augustus Caesar built temples devoted to himself with the inscription, to the god Augustus. That's what those temples had on them. Nero called himself God while he lived. He felt he was God. Domitian was called our God and Lord. Well, all that's going to climax in the 1-7th head, which is going to be blasphemous just like the preceding six. Well, let's look at chapter 13, verse 2. It's going to all climax in what is called the abomination of desolation, with the Antichrist going into the Holy of Holies, claiming to be God. It says in verse 2, and the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. Well, that's kind of interesting. You won't see an animal like that in the zoo. As far as having a mouth of a lion and the feet of a bear and the body of a leopard. And actually, when you study this carefully, these are elements and characteristics of previous world empires. That's what it's really talking about here. And so there are going to be various characteristics of the previous world empires that are going to be embodied in this last final world empire. And that's what makes it far more dreadful in its power. Far more dreadful in its blasphemy than anything else that the world has ever seen. This is going to combine a number of the strengths, so-called strengths, demonic strengths, if you will, of the preceding empires. Now, you've got to turn back to Daniel chapter 7 to really see what these animals symbolize here. Let me turn back to Daniel chapter 7. Later on, we're going to look at Daniel 7, so I'm not going to explain all the typology and symbolism here, other than to tell you basically what these animals represent, what nation that is. Daniel chapter 7, 1 through 8, although I would like to be reading in verse 2. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. That's going to be the battle amongst the nations. And you find when the world was in a state of chaos, that's often when these world empires would arise. Look in verse 3. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. Now he's seeing four separate empires that were going to occur in the future. It says in verse 4, the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given unto it. Now that represents Babylon. The lion would represent Babylon. Now realize, he doesn't see the two earlier kingdoms, Egypt and Assyria. They've already fallen. And Daniel is in Babylon. He's receiving a vision of the future kingdoms, starting with the one that was then in existence, Babylon. Verse 5, and behold another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. That represents the kingdom of Medo-Persia. The kingdom of Persia was like a bear in its nature, devoured much flesh. Verse 6, after this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of its four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. That represents Greece now. Those three animals are the very ones that are mentioned in Revelation chapter 13. So what John is really seeing now is that the one end time Antichrist system is going to have elements of those three kingdoms, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. Let me tell you how. First of all, in Revelation 13, verse 2, we see the lion. It says the mouth of a lion, particularly. That represents the kingdom of Babylon. That's symbolizing ferocity. That's symbolizing great strength. and the greatness of Babylon. A lion is incredibly powerful, very, very strong. Now, in the book of Revelation, the picture is of a mouth of a lion. And that means that the beast is going to speak with a roar. He's going to devour all of his opposers. It speaks of the deceptiveness that comes out of its mouth and the great chaos that is going to come out of that mouth. You see, the lion blends a number of qualities, particularly massive strength with feline dexterity. You know, a cat, even a little house cat, very strong. Do you ever get a house cat mad at you and try to take something out of its paws or whatever? It'll tear your hand to pieces. They're very strong for their size and very dexterous. I mean, if they bat at you with their paw, they're 10 times quicker than you. They're sly, they're stealthy, and they're treacherous, you know, including our cat. We've got a couple of birds at our bird feeder, and we put bells around his neck, and he still gets them. But that's the way a cat is. It's their very nature. They're sly, and they're sneaky, and they're quick like that. And this is what the Antichrist is going to be like. Very strong, very powerful, but sly and stealthy. And then the bear, there are elements of the bear here, and particularly in the book of Revelation, in chapter 13 and verse 2, it says that he has the feet of a bear, I believe. Isn't that what it says? The feet of a bear. And what that is talking about, again, is the power to crush. Just picture in your mind a grizzly bear. The power to crush, the power to charge. It shows the great conquest and the lumbering nature, as it were, of the Antichrist kingdom. You see, Medo-Persia had a tremendous ability, and that's what the bear represents in the book of Daniel, is the kingdom of Medo-Persia. They had incredible armies like you can't believe. They would field 1 million or 1.5 million men. That's as many as are in America, in America's armies. And they would send them out with battle elephants and everything else. And you know what their tactic was for conquering other kingdoms? Go down and mow them over. And they just all got in a big line and just marched with their elephants and came with their bows and arrows and their spears and everything and just slaughtered people, just mowed them right over, just crushed them, just annihilated all opposition. That's what the Antichrist kingdom is going to be like as well. The feet of the bear just lumbering across the earth with no real, you know, opponents to stop it, with no one really to somehow challenge it, and the Antichrist kingdom is going to have the power to crush the world. And then the leopard. And then the leopard, the body of a leopard. That represents Greece. The body of a leopard speaks of great agility and also fierce cruelty. A leopard is a very cruel animal, a very agile animal. It also speaks of great speed of conquest. I suppose a leopard is one of the fastest animals, four-footed animals on the face of the earth. I'm not sure if a cheetah qualifies as a leopard or not, but leopards are extremely fast. And see, this relates to the nation of Greece back in the book of Daniel. And just in a number of years, Alexander the Great started conquering the world, I think, at the age of 20. By the time he was 31 or 32, the whole world they had to see. Everywhere from the Grecian Empire itself all the way over to the Indus River Valley. And then he sat down and cried. He wanted more to conquer. It's like he conquered everything. And really, he did it in much quicker time than even that. He really conquered the world just in a number of years. And that is referring to the great speed of conquest of the Antichrist system, the cat-like vigilance and the craft of the Antichrist system. The devil is going to conquer this world with lightning speed. He's going to go forth on, he's going to be that white horse rider on that white horse. And he's going to go forth with great speed. He knows he only has 3.5 years. He's not going to dilly-dally around. He's not going to take his time. And he's going to go forth to conquer very quickly, subduing all opposition. So really, by way of conclusion then, what we're seeing here are features of some of the previous world empires, which is going to give the Antichrist kingdom its awesome power and stature. And they're going to be combined into really one picture here. Well, then, let's read on in verse 2 here. It says, "And his mouth is like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority." The dragon gave him, and now you could translate it or its. The dragon gave it its power. And so really we see the devil now, don't we, as the power behind this beast, just like he was the power behind the 6 previous world kingdoms. And he's been working all along to bring man under his dominion, and we find that the Antichrist is going to be Satan-possessed, probably. He's going to speak by the devil. The dragon is giving this Antichrist system its power, its dunamis. And also, the devil is going to give the Antichrist system his seat. And that means throne. Throne. See, the devil possesses the world. The authority of the devil is worldwide. He has worldwide dominion. He is like Jesus said, the prince of this world. And so he therefore has the authority to give this world government his throne. That's what he will do. And then he's going to give the world system great authority. That's exousia, the Greek word for authority. Look at some of the following verses. Verse 7 of chapter 13. There's authority over every tribe and tongue and people and nation. Look at verse 8. All that dwell on the earth shall worship him. Except the tribulation church, of course. Verse 16. He causes all, small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive the mark of the beast. And verse 17. No man can buy or sell without the mark of the beast. Well, that's authority. That's power. And he is given that authority by the devil. Then verse 3. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after the beast. So he saw one of the heads wounded. Now, it must be the seventh head. It would have to be the seventh head that is wounded. It doesn't tell you which head it is. But it would have to be the seventh head, because there's no wounds seen earlier in chapter 12 and verse 3. When you read chapter 12 and verse 3, in the earlier vision of this same basic creature, there's no wound that you find on any of the other heads. And so the wound must occur then after chapter 12 and verse 3, sometime in the last days. It could not be on one of the preceding six heads. There's no really recorded healing of any of the previous empires with the whole world wondering after it. It would be limited to the seventh head sometime after the man-child ministry, apparently. Now, the Bible says, as it were wounded. As it were wounded. That points to a figurative wounding of the seventh head. So we're not talking about a literal assassination attempt on the Antichrist with him, you know, coming back to death. Or coming back to life, I should say. Now, when it says, as it were, that doesn't mean it didn't really happen. It just simply is telling you this is a vision. It's a symbol. So it really did happen. This head really has a death stroke to it. World government is really killed, and something levels that death stroke to it. Let me turn over to chapter 17, verse 8. I'd like to have you read with me in your Bibles here. I'd like to have you see this. The seventh head is actually going to be killed for just a period of time. Look at chapter 17, verse 8. The beast that thou sawest was and is not. Now, wait a minute. How can that be? How can the beast that thou sawest, he says it was and it is not all of a sudden. There's the death wound. It is not. And shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. And it shall go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, there's the death wound, so it exists, and then it is not, the death wound, and then it is. It comes back to life again. And the world is going to wonder. The world is going to marvel when they see that. So it's like all of a sudden it exists, and then it has a death wound to it. It no longer exists. The Bible said it is not, and then it comes back to life again. And certainly that's going to evoke a lot of worship on the earth. Then look down at verse 11 again. And the beast, read carefully now, that was and is not, see that? He exists, and then he is not, that's the death wound, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. Now wait a minute, now it's getting confusing. No, it isn't, not really. It's like the beast is the seventh head, and then he is not. He is not, because he's wounded to death. And then he comes back to life again. And now it's like it's a brand new kingdom, only it's of the seventh. It's the same one, but it's like almost a new kingdom, as it were. So it says it's the eighth, as it were. There's only really seven kingdoms, though. So it's like it's going to be totally, as it were, put to death, and then it will come back to life again. It's the same kingdom, but really it comes back to life, as it were, twice. Once before the rapture, it's existing, and then sometime after the rapture. Now, we find in the book of Revelation, chapter 13 here, that this wound is given by a sword down in verse 14. We talked about that earlier. I'm not going to elaborate on it, but in my opinion, the sword is probably a symbol of the truth of the Word of God. actually wielded by the man-child in verse 14. Let me read a couple translations to you, because here when we read in the King James, it says, as it were wounded, and that really doesn't convey the idea. The idea is of an actual death stroke. It's not just wounded. It's not like it's there and it is somehow just kind of hindered a little bit and wounded a little bit. It is put to death. Here's what it says literally. And I saw one of its heads as though it had been slaughtered to death, but its death stroke was cured. So this head, it's going to be slaughtered. That sword is going to slaughter it. And then I like Kenneth Wiest. Here's how he translates it. And one of his heads appeared to have been mortally wounded, the throat having been slashed. And his death stroke was healed. I like that. It's like the throat is literally slashed. And you know, when your jugular vein is slashed, that's a death stroke for you if you don't get help pretty soon. But then it says that his deadly wound was healed. His deadly wound was healed. And so this wound is going to be healed. And you could translate it deadly wound, you could translate it death stroke here. So really what I'm saying is that it's not just a deadly wound, but actually the whole seventh head died. Now I want you to notice something carefully. John didn't see the beast being wounded in the beginning of the tribulation. He's not saying that. But by this time the wound has already been inflicted and the head has already been healed. So something before the tribulation and something after chapter 12 and verse 3 caused that death stroke. And again, the only thing that we can really see that would really cause something like that would probably be the man-child, because that's who the beast is waiting to devour. And incidentally, I don't think the rapture is the wound. Some have wondered, some of my students have asked me, well, maybe the rapture is the wound. I don't think so. I don't think the rapture would really be qualified as a sword, and I don't think the rapture would really stop world government, and then it would come back to life again. I think something before the rapture is going to happen that would slash the throat of this seventh head. Look what is going to be the impact on the world now. Chapter 13, and then verse 3. And all the world wondered after the beast. Great awe. Great awe. Because the system is put under for a time, now it surges back with more strength than ever. Now, question, how can that happen? How can you have a world government and its throat is slashed and there's a death stroke to it and then it surges back into power again? How can that take place? How can that really occur? There are two reasons why that can occur. Number one is that the Antichrist and the ten horns and all of their associates and all of their henchmen and followers, they've been working behind the scenes to regain and recoup what's been lost. You don't think the Antichrist is going to come into the man-child ministry, do you? No, no way. You don't think the ten kings are, do you? No, no way. In fact, they're probably going to discern what is happening, and they're going to retreat to their secret places, as it were, and they're going to plot and plan and scheme, and they're going to recoup their losses very rapidly as soon as the man-child is gone. But then there's a second reason why this head can surge back with such immense speed. And the second reason is this: the devil is now cast down to the earth. And the devil is now working personally, directly amongst the men. And you know, things go a lot different in a military army when the general is right there to direct things. You can have a lieutenant right out of officer's training school. He goes up to the sergeants and everything, and he says, now this is what we need to do. Do this, and I want you to dig that foxhole over there. And they take their time, and they shuffle around and everything. And they don't, you know, they don't respond to that new young lieutenant like they do the five-star general. And the five-star general comes walking down with these five stars on each lapel, and he says, dig that foxhole over there. And I mean, there's nothing but dust flying. It looks like a Wolverine digging that thing. And there's a difference. There's a difference. And so when the devil all of a sudden is cast onto the earth and he's furious, he's upset. I mean, he's full of wrath and fury. Well, you'll find that things are going to go differently on the earth. He's going to whip this world into his demonic shape in a hurry. Well, I need to read verse 4 now. And they worship the dragon which gave power unto the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? So they worship the dragon. Now in verse 4, they worship the dragon. You know who the dragon is? That's Satan. So the world is worshiping Satan. And that is going to be the final form of apostasy now. Not just simply the worship of some pagan deity or some idol or some statue or anything like that, but the direct worship of Satan himself is going to occur on this earth. And there's already trends of that right now. I mean it. There are trends of that. There are people, they are Satan worshipers right now. There are churches that are devoted to Satan. I don't know how strong this is, but I read in one of David Wilkerson's letters not too long ago that there were actually some kids from a posh area of, I think, Manhattan or something like this, Long Island or whatever. They actually sacrificed one of their friends to Satan. And I've seen other things like with the rock music. A lot of the rock music, it is totally of the devil. They're worshiping the devil right in those rock concerts and so forth. And I also heard of one particular group that actually gives an altar call to Lucifer at the end of their rock concert. And they have people come down and give their lives to Lucifer, give their lives to Satan. And this has been the original sinful ambition of the devil down through time. He has wanted this very thing. He has wanted the world to worship him, but he's been limited because man has been prone to worship God, although some have worshipped him. And you might want to look at Isaiah chapter 14, 12 through 14. Isaiah chapter 14, 12 through 14. Then I want to read to you Luke chapter 4 and verse 7. Luke 4, 7. The devil said unto Jesus, "All this power will I give thee, and the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will I give it. If thou therefore wilt worship me, all shall be thine." Jesus answered and said unto him, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve." Oh, the devil, he put everything right on that bargaining table. I mean, he put everything he had, all of his kingdoms, if Jesus would just bow down and worship him. He longs for the worship of man. He longs for it. And incidentally, the devil has always attracted heathen worship to himself through demons.
Yeah.
And scriptures on this, Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 16 through 18. Deuteronomy 32, 16 through 18. And Psalm 106 and verse 37. And 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 20. So there is going to be an increase of satanic worship, and it's going to culminate and climax in the worship of the devil himself during the tribulation. And they're going to worship Satan. Now, also, notice something carefully here in chapter 13 and verse 4. It says that they worship someone else as well. It says not only do they worship the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, but they worship the beast, saying, "Who is able to make war with him?" Now they are worshiping the beast system. They're worshiping the Antichrist system. You say, well, how can they do that? Well, they're actually worshiping the government that they are under. Now, we know that the beast here is primarily the system because down in verse 5, there is a mouth that is given onto the system, and the system is the seventh head, and then there is a mouth given to it. Let me read to you verse 5. "And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies." You could say there was a mouth given unto it. And the mouth is the Antichrist, and the head is the Antichrist system. So, in other words, people are actually worshiping the Antichrist system here. And incidentally, in ancient Rome, people were taught to worship the state. And they had state worship. They worshipped it. And later on, it developed into emperor worship because the state worship was too impersonal. But you see, most of the world at this time, they're going to be dedicated, they're going to be committed to world government. And they're going to worship it. It's going to hold absolute sway in their life. I think of the words that I read some time ago of a man called Nechayev. He was a 19th century disciple of Karl Marx, who was not a saint of God. And Nechayev was thrown into prison for his role in the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. But right prior to his death, he wrote this. Quote, "The revolutionary man is a consecrated man. He has neither his own interest, nor concerns, nor feelings, no attachment, nor property, not even a name. All for him is absorbed in a single exclusive interest, in the one thought, in one passion, revolution." End quote. So in other words, there was a man, he took his entire life, and he said, I don't want a name, I don't want a reputation for myself, I don't want any worldly goods, I am a consecrated man, I'm devoted to one thing, and that's revolution, that's communism, that's all I'm devoted to. He worshipped that system. And see, there are people, they worship communism, they worship the actual system itself. Now, we find from verse 8 that they're also going to worship the man, the Antichrist, at the head of the system. Let me read to you verse 8. "And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him." And there's that masculine intensive pronoun, alton. It's talking about the devil now, him. whose names are not written in the book of life are the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So they're going to worship the Antichrist himself. And, of course, he's indwelt by Satan. So they're indirectly worshiping Satan through him. And he's going to be the devil's substitute for Jesus Christ as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And the whole world is going to flock to him as well to give him homage. And so we know that the world will worship him as well. It says in Daniel 11:36, that the Antichrist will magnify himself above every god. And so we know that this is going to happen. Now listen to the words of the world. What is the world crying out here in verse 4 here? Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? In other words, the world is now captivated. The world is now entranced and enthralled by the glory and the power of the world government. They can conceive of none greater in the universe. The world government is the greatest power. They ascribe praise to this invincible being. Look at him. They're marveling. They're wondering at him. They're loving him. They're loving their world government. Utopia at last. The World Federation is here. Brotherhood, socialism, the common bond of friendship amongst all men, regardless of what you believe. And incidentally, all the previous world empires have always been loved and always been wondered at and always been held in awe. Babylon with its golden majesty of architecture and the splendor of its sovereign rule. And when you study the ancient city of Babylon, they worship the kingdom itself. Medo-Persia with its massive towering military might. Greece, look at how the world has worshipped Greece. With all the polish and elegance of human intellect and all the art combined with democracy and all the philosophy and everything. And Rome with all of its incredible wealth and all of its territory and the idea of justice and, you know, iron might and military discipline and so forth. The world has worshipped these systems and given their awe to it. And then there's a question that the world is saying. Who is able to make war with him? Or you could say it. Who is able to make war with it? Which shows that the nations by now have been forced to submit their weaponry to perhaps something like a world federation. And they are now controlled completely. And the Antichrist is not going to have any real serious contenders for his office at this time. But we can answer that question, can't we? Who is going to make war with him? God is saying, is someone saying something here? Is someone challenging me? What did the ancient knights used to do? They used to throw something on the ground to challenge someone else to a battle and so forth. Well, that's exactly what God is going to do here. He's going to accept that challenge. And Jesus himself, personally, is going to make war with them, manifested in great power at his second coming, in which he's going to cast the beast into the lake of fire. He's going to take him and throw him into the lake of fire. And it says in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 11. Revelation chapter 19, verse 11. And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called faithful and true, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. And so Jesus is going to make war with them. In fact, the war really commences with the seven plagues that are dropped on the earth. They're like God's spiritual nuclear bombs that are dropped on the earth to kind of prime the pump for the last final battle at Armageddon. And then I think of Exodus chapter 15 and verse 3, and there it talks about God. And the Israelites on the other side of the Red Sea when they came through, they said, God is a God of war. And they were praising God for that. And you know, when the Egyptians came through that Red Sea, it says that God took the wheels off their chariots. And the Bible says, the King James, I love it, it says, their chariots drave hard. You know? Their chariots drave hard. And God is a God of war, and God is going to battle against them. And so right now they're totally enamored of this. Yes.
You said that a mouthpiece was given to him, the beast. Now, is that the parallel to 6-2, where he comes with the second revealing?
Yep, same thing. Now, it seems incredible to many, and I'm not going to take the time to document this, although I do have a number of interesting facts and so forth, but I might have time later to bring them to you. It seems incredible to us in Christian America, I really don't even like that term anymore, that the world could be taught to worship the devil and Satan, you know, the world government and the Antichrist and everything. And it really seems incredible that America could fall, you know, to a lot of people. It seems incredible that this could ever come to pass. But right now, I believe that America is very rapidly being paganized. by a number of different areas, very, very rapidly. And in fact, the nation right now is being conditioned to accept the world government, and it's going to come from a number of areas. It's going to come through fear. It's going to come through economic crises. It's going to come through chaos and crime all out of proportion, in which the world is just going to clamor for iron justice. It's going to come from weakness in the face of the communistic threat. It's going to come through the media, as well as by sin and drugs and licentiousness. It's going to come through the occult. As more and more people open up to the occult, that gives the devil strongholds in our nation that he never had before, and God's blessing has got to be lifted off of the nation. And there are going to be crises and calamities that are going to condition the world and the nations to look for the answer in a world Superman. And things are going to increase on a proportion that we've never seen before. And eventually, when he appears, the world is going to worship him, and the world is going to clamor for him. You might want to read one interesting article. I don't know if you've seen it. I've read it. It's called The Conspiracy Against America. And you can get this on the free literature table in the front foyer there. But there really are a lot of interesting points that they bring out in this little article here. And should time permit, I'm going to bring a number of things as well a little bit later on in time on this. I'm not sure if I'll have time or not, though. But chapter 13, verse 5. And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Now, this mouth is parallel to verse 2, where we saw the mouth as a lion on the seventh head. Parallel scripture, really. The seventh head would represent the Antichrist world government, and the mouth that is given to the seventh head would represent the Antichrist himself. He's going to be the mouthpiece of the world government. He is going to be the mouthpiece of Satan in the tribulation. And notice what he's going to do. He's going to speak great things and blasphemies. And the Bible says, out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh. And deep in the inner recesses of his heart dwells Satan himself. And the Antichrist, mark my words, will be a silver-throated orator, possessed with a satanic eloquence. Just like if you've seen old flicks, old films of Adolf Hitler, and the amazing oratory ability of that man. He was, I'm sure, demon-possessed. And I wouldn't be surprised if the devil didn't speak through him many times. He had incredible power to draw people to himself with dazzling words of rhetoric, and the Antichrist is going to do the same thing. Let me read some scriptures to you from the book of Daniel. Let me read to you Daniel chapter 7, and let me read to you verse 8. Daniel chapter 7, verse 8. I considered the horns, and he's looking at these 10 horns now on the Antichrist system, and there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. That's the Antichrist. Then look at verse 20. And of the 10 horns that were in the head, and of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld in the same horn made war with the saints. The Antichrist again. Look at verse 25. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and a dividing of time. Then look over at chapter 8 and verse 23. Chapter 8, verse 23. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. It's talking about a man with great wisdom, great understanding, great knowledge. He can understand enigmas, dark sentences that no one else has understood. Then look at verse 24. This is interesting. And his power shall be mighty, talking about the Antichrist, this king of a fierce countenance. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall be mighty, but not by his own power. By whose power? By Satan's power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, that means awesomely. And he shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. Has the idea of merchandise. And he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. That's that white horse he's going to appear on, and he's going to come, and he's going to be dazzling the world. Then turn over to chapter 11, look at verse 36. Chapter 11, verse 36. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things about the God of gods. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to speak positive things. That means, you know, things of pride against God. And shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. Therefore, some have felt like he might be a Jew, because he's not regarding the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and so forth. Nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. And what that means, he's going to be working in cahoots with the devil. He's going to be worshiping the devil, getting his ability from the devil, speaking the devil's words and philosophies, and not worshiping the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is the true God of heaven. Now, it says in verse 5, it goes on here in Revelation 13, that power was given unto him to continue for 42 months. For 42 months. So he does have authority to act for 42 months. Now, question. If this 42-month reign begins right after the rapture, and the Antichrist is still alive and ruling up to the second coming, which very possibly is 7 years later, why does the Bible say he only has authority for 42 months, which is 3.5 years? Doesn't he have authority for the second 3.5 years? Well, a couple things that I'd like to say to that. First of all, 42 months is his allotted time to reign supremely. But that supreme reign is going to end at the end of the sixth seal. Yes, he will reign supremely for 3.5 years. And it is true that the two witnesses are a thorn in his side that are going to tend to discredit him and hinder him, but they're not going to stop him. And he's going to overcome them at the end of that 42 months. And during that 42-month period of time, the world is going to cry, "Who is able to make war with him?" But you'll notice after the sixth seal, they don't cry that any longer. Because after the sixth seal, God starts pouring out the plagues on him. And in fact, even at the time of the sixth seal, people retreat to the caves, and they retreat to the rocks, and they cry for the rocks to fall on them. They're not saying any longer, "Who is able to make war with him?" For the great day of God's wrath sets in then during the seventh seal. And in fact, notice chapter 16 and verse 10, the fifth plague directly smites his throne in chapter 16 and verse 10, and his kingdom becomes full of darkness. That demonic plague is going to come upon his kingdom, but the beast system is going to keep on thrashing with the death rattle in its throat for a little while until the second coming, and he's going to make one final all-out bid to dominate the world at Armageddon, but that's not going to be very long-lived. It's going to be short-lived. And besides, by that time, his empire is going to be fractured. And then in the seventh plague, the Antichrist is going to be cast into the lake of fire. So you see, he reigns supremely for 3.5 years, the first six seals. But then when the seventh seal is opened up and the plagues are being dumped out on his kingdom, he's not reigning with the same power. He's not reigning with the same authority. And his power is waning by that time. Let me say something about the term Antichrist. The term Antichrist. Let me say, first of all, that I don't believe that the world is going to call him that. I think that it's the saints, it's God's people that call him that. In other words, I don't think you'll read in the New York Times, "The Antichrist wins the bid for the Worldwide Federation. Welcome, Antichrist." And that term is not going to be used by the world, I don't believe. And incidentally, this term is not used in the book of Revelation, but it is used of this very man in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18. 1 John chapter 2, verse 18. John uses it a total of 4 times, and the term does occur only 4 times in the New Testament. But 1 John chapter 2, verse 18. Here's what it says. "Little children, it is the last time, and as you have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby we know that it is the last time." So those were just simply foreshadows, forerunners of the great end time Antichrist to come. Well, we'll look at this here. When? Tomorrow? Tomorrow? Tomorrow's Wednesday. Right, okay. Hi.
Thank you.